is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome the author, Patrick O'Donnell. His new book, The Indispensables, the diverse soldier mariners who shaped the country, formed the Navy, and rode Washington across the Delaware. It is April 1775, April 18th to 19th, the night of the Black Horse Tavern in Menotomy, Massachusetts. Menotomy is a word meaning swift water, Mystic River. It is now part of Arlington. In that inn, the Black Horse Tavern, are three prominent members of the Marblehead leadership, the Marbleheaders. That is what Patrick is focusing us on. He's telling the story of the early years of the Revolution, the Civil War, between the Marbleheaders and first the British overlords, and then the Marbleheaders versus the British Army, involved in, critical to, the success of Washington's Continental Army. But this night, these three men have been at the Black Horse Tavern through the day, meeting with other leaders of the nascent revolutionary thinking in Massachusetts. And they've gone to bed, unaware that very close by, in a place called Lexington, there are Minutemen gathering to confront the British light infantry marched out under Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith to raid the stores, the ordnance stores at Lexington and Concord. The British come out for black powder and guns. These three men are asleep. Around 2 o'clock in the morning, they're awakened and told, the British are coming. The British are coming. They cannot flee. They think the British are coming to arrest them. They're wanted men if it's revealed what they're up to, which is to provide black powder to the nascent revolutionaries. They run into a cornfield and spend the night there in the dark, in the cold, because the British are actually on the road. Patrick, congratulations. Wonderful. I'm lying in a cornfield with Messrs. Elbridge, Jerry, Azor Orne, and one other, leaderships of the Marbleheaders. Who are they to Marblehead? Why are they there then? And what is it that they make of what they see of the British come marching? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. It's great to be back on the show, and it's really an honor. I always relish and treasure our conversations. Well, we're in this cornfield because they are members of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress. They sit on the key committees of supply and safety, and it's the Marbleheaders that brought in the bulk of the powder that the British are trying to seize, as well as the arms and cannon. It's Marbleheaders that that had access to Spain, that where they brought in a sizable amount of powder, black powder, which is the most crucial resource in the early days. It doesn't exist in the colonies. The British know that. They know that we have guns, but guns are useless without gunpowder, and they are actively trying to seize all the gunpowder in New England and secure it in other portions of the colonies as well. And that night, the British are on the march under Colonel Francis Smith. 700 men are going towards Lexington and Concord to seize these vital supplies that the Marbleheaders had through their supply lines brought in. And they see this massive column, a scarlet column of British soldiers that are marching towards Concord. And they also, some of the members of this column go into the tavern, and they feel that they're after them. And they then flee to the cornfield, and they're hiding for their lives.
Down the road, nearby, the confrontation at Lexington has already taken place. However, there will be another battle the next day. It's not just the Minutemen, because the 700 British soldiers, the Redcoats, go on to Concord, where there's a battle there as well. But Patrick also tells the story of the Battle of Menotomy. It takes place on the 19th. In other words, they lay in the cornfield all night. They come back out again, but the British are marching back towards Boston. And come running are not just the Minutemen of the night before, but the Minutemen of Marblehead, including John Glover. That battle, Patrick, engaged by the Marbleheaders, who led it? Who commanded it? And what was the result of that battle on the 19th?
this is basically, we're talking about the shot heard around the world at first at Lexington Green with Parker and his men, and then at Concord Bridge. But then the British under Colonel Smith have a problem. They're far away from Boston, and they have to march through thousands of Minutemen and militia that have assembled to block their advance. This is called Battle Road because they literally are fighting for their lives from Concord back to Boston. And this small task force is now outgunned. And there are thousands of angry militiamen and Minutemen that are trying to block their advance, including the Marbleheaders that now they hear what's going on, and they come with their musket in hand, and they are trying to stop the British from getting back to Boston. And they're at Arlington, today's Arlington or Monadnock, and they're battling. And there's a place called the Russell House, where one of the great engagements take place, and many patriots are slaughtered here. The blood is literally ankle deep in one of the rooms.
What is striking to me about the Battle of Monadnock, Patrick, as a reader, is that at Lexington, the engagement was one-sided. The British troops, light infantry, these are good troops. They charge with bayonets and slaughter a few. And at Concord, it's a meeting engagement, but really people are withdrawing all the time, trying to back away from the British firing line. At Monadnock, that's a stand. That means to attack, and the British lose a lot of casualties at Monadnock. The Marbleheaders at this point, do they realize they're now in completely, that there's no backing out, that they're now in revolution from London? Do they talk
some
about
of them,
it?
Some of them do, and some of them don't. I mean, you have another figure in the book that is bringing the Salem militia, for instance, and he kind of delays. That's what one of the theories are, that he could have actually cut off the British from entering Boston potentially. And, they just don't know yet. But, I mean, people are starting to sense that they're probably all in because the crown is going to brand them all traitors. And another aspect of the book that's, I think, really important is the narrative. And the Americans may not have pioneered the term information warfare, but they understood it. And Elbridge Gerry, who's a main character in this book, after the battles of Lexington and Concord, is put in charge of gleaning or develop the depositions that will be needed to build the American narrative. And they interview British soldiers. They interview the main patriots that are involved in the battle, and they get their oral histories or depositions, and they assemble them. And I think the most interesting story in the book, or one of them, is a forgotten voyage that nobody's really heard of or thought about, is that they find the fastest ship that they can get. Gage's ship leaves days earlier with their version of the story. But the Marbleheaders and Salemites find the fastest ship that they can find, and they deliver the narrative or these depositions along with a paper from Salem. And it gets to England first, 2 weeks before Gage's story. And it's a sensation. I mean, this is earth-shattering news that changes the empire overnight.
Englishmen bayoneting Englishmen, yes.
And it's the crown that is the aggressor in the American narrative, and it's the crown that fired first, and that becomes all important.
This is about the Marbleheaders. So what about Marblehead? We're going there now, thanks to Patrick O'Donnell. The Indispensables is the book. The diverse soldier mariners who shaped the country, formed the Navy, and rode Washington across the Delaware. We've got a lot of water crossings ahead of us. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Patrick O'Donnell, his new book, The Indispensables, the diverse soldier mariners who shaped the country, formed the Navy, and rode Washington across the Delaware. Right now, we want to discover Marblehead, about 18 miles to the northeast of Boston, on the water, and it is a prosperous town in the 18th century. Patrick, you estimate about 5,000. Its business was fishing. What was its relation to Boston and Massachusetts' economy?
It's the second largest port city in Massachusetts, and it's a thriving cosmopolitan city. And its fortunes are made on fish, specifically codfish. And the men of Marblehead fish the Grand Banks. This is, you know, well over 1,000 miles to the north up near Nova Scotia. But the Grand Banks are teeming with codfish, in some cases, which are, you know, 100 pounds or more, John. And they fish the Grand Banks, bring back the cod, and then they trade the cod, which they put in salted barrels for other goods. And they have a massive, merchant fleet that they've developed, where they trade around the world and bring goods in and out of Marblehead.
In 1774, October of 1774, Marblehead obeys the orders, the directions, the guidelines of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress to form a militia. These are the Minutemen that are at Lexington and Concord. Each town is to have its own militia, and Patrick's reporting, about 50, with sergeants and lieutenants and colonels. That becomes the core of the Marblehead Regiment that will spend years as parts of the Continental Army. Important to introduce some of the players here. Colonel Jeremiah Lee and Lieutenant John Glover. I'm going to key on Glover because it's a discovery to me to meet John Glover. What is he in 1774, Patrick?
John Gulliver starts out, he's a self-made man, John, and a very wealthy self-made man. About 5'3", stocky, red-haired, very scrappy. Begins life as a cobbler, does shoes and fishes as well, but builds up enough money to build a bar, which is extremely successful, and he buys his first ship, and then it's one ship after another from there, and he builds a fleet of ships, fishing ships as well as trading ships. And John Glover is a self-made man. They respect self-made individuals in Marblehead. And Marblehead has some of the wealthiest men in the colonies, and they are part of this regiment that's forming, this militia group. Jeremiah Lee, for instance, is considered one of the wealthiest men in the 13th colonies, and just enormous wealth. And it's matched with his waistline. He's just a rotund guy, nearly 300 pounds. But he's also extremely wealthy and extremely influential. And these men are part of the Massachusetts provisional government. And some of the key committees are all chaired, or they are the key members of these committees, which are the levers of power prior to the Revolutionary War. A lot of decisions are made. They're bringing in gunpowder supplies, for instance. They're bringing in cannon through their trade routes, which they convert into supply lines. They have key relationships with the King of Spain and the trading families in Spain, which are our first foreign aid in 1774.
The formation of the Marblehead Minutemen includes men of color who are part of the fishing fleet. Patrick follows the stories that we have today, Manuel Soto, Caesar Glover, Romeo, other names come and go through the course of the war, part of the Marblehead unit, because they sail together, they fight together. And we're going to put them immediately into the fight for powder. It's about powder. The British understand that depriving powder ends the possibility of revolt. Patrick identifies the raid on Fort William and Mary, a powder bivouac of the British Army. It's in the Piscataway River, which is between now New Hampshire and Maine. At that point, Maine was part of Massachusetts. Between New Hampshire and Maine, and it's an island called Newcastle Island. This is December 14th, 1774. It's led by a man named John Langdon, participating as the Marbleheader and sailor Winborne Adams. What is the result of their raid, Patrick? Is it successful?
It is, John. Fort William and Mary is a decrepit, it's hard to even call it a fort in 1774, but it was a main powder source for the British Army. And they also had a number of cannon there. And the Marbleheaders, through their intelligence, tip off the folks up in near Portsmouth that the British are coming to seize the powder. And they basically mount a raid John Sullivan is in the lead along with Langdon. They assemble a mob of several hundred men, and they storm the fort. And it's quite an interesting story because inside the fort are five, I wouldn't call them redcoats. They're actually Americans that are in the employ of the Crown. And they try to resist, and they fire several shots. These are the first shots of the American Revolution. A couple of men are wounded. The cannon is fired. They storm the walls, and they seize the powder. But before that, there's a lot of really interesting dynamics. There's first woman that's a loyalist combatant that hands the pistols to her husband to defend themselves. There's a lot of intrigue that goes on, but they eventually seize the powder and the cannon. They conduct two raids just before Crown reinforcements under General Gage arrive.
That powder becomes critical. It's distributed throughout the hands of the patriots. They call themselves, many of them are either Sons of Liberty or sympathetic to the Sons of Liberty. At the same time, there are loyalists among them. And I mentioned there was a purge of the loyalists at the Marblehead Regiment before. The loyalists, however, can easily disguise themselves being part of the communities. So, Patrick, in your telling, I see very clearly we can call this a revolution, but it's also a civil war between factions who live together.
It's very much a civil war. It's a raging civil war. And one of the, many characters in this book are targeted. The main character in my book, or one of them, is Dr. Nathaniel Bond. And Dr. Bond is a virus specialist. But during the Battle of Lexington and Concord, which we talked about, he treated British soldiers. And for that, he was canceled. And what I mean by that is they felt that he was a loyalist after doing that. It's just following his Hippocratic Oath, but he treated these British soldiers. His house was surrounded. And I own the original letter that Dr. Bond wrote to Elbridge Gerry demanding, my house is surrounded. There's thousands of people that have threatened to kill me. If you don't send an armed guard immediately, I'll be dead tomorrow. And they do that, and he asks for a court-martial, and he presents the evidence of what he did, which is nothing wrong, and he was exonerated. But that's the level of – there's lots of political violence in this book. There's a lot of cancel culture, if you will, things that are part of the Civil War that is taking place.
And that Civil War will not be resolved. The loyalists have as much claim on the land and their property as the apparent rebels. In fact, repeatedly in the contest, and Patrick quotes from what we have, the sources at the time, the redcoats were routinely encouraged to call the people they were attacking rebels, not Englishmen, rebels, which explains why they bayoneted them to death, even though they'd surrendered. There was genuine enmity and hatred between the British regulars, these are first-rate troops, and the Marbleheaders and their colleagues. When we come back, Bunker Hill and Marbleheaders. Patrick O'Donnell, the book is The Indispensables. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Patrick O'Donnell. His book, The Indispensables, the story of the Marbleheaders through the Revolutionary War, also a civil war. And it is now 1775. We go to the very famous Bunker Hill, which is also Breed's Hill, in Charlestown, outside of Boston Harbor. And what's critical here is not that the Patriots will be overrun by the attacking British redcoats. What's critical is the Marbleheaders' participation and their opinion of their fight that day. Patrick, again and again, I'm reminded that the revolution was about gunpowder. You've made it very clear that you can have all these intentions to live free, but if you can't shoot back, they're going to come to nothing. The gunpowder at Bunker Hill, was that provided by the Committee of Supply and Safety? Was that Marbleheader gunpowder?
Yes, it was. In fact, that was the crucial supply. There wasn't enough, and they were able to repel charge after charge of British charge after charge on the hill, and then the powder ran out. And it's Samuel Trevitt has a – this is sort of the untold story that's the – revealed really for the first time.
Trevitt's a marbleheader and one of the leaders of the militia. Go ahead, Francis.
He has a company of cannon, several cannon that are on Bunker Hill, and he's fighting back. They're using canister. They're firing everything that they possibly can into the British ranks, and they're repelling them. And it's Samuel Trevitt's cannon. It's some of the few, the only cannon that are actually participating. There are others that are there, but they withdraw. They fear for their lives because the British are coming with pretty much everything they have, and they fight back very, very significantly there. And it's very interesting. It's Trevitt that repels charge after charge, but Trevitt at the end of the battle is mistaken for another man that had withdrawn, and he's court-martialed. And that's a massive insult for somebody that's really one of the true heroes of Bunker Hill. And he leaves the service after that. But several of the other men that are in the company stay on and they continue to battle.
This is before the Continental Army. This is before. These are a militia who are all volunteers, all of them. And there's a sense of order that is distributed. There's no one particular commander. Washington doesn't arrive for another month. This is June of 1775. Dr. Warren is killed that day. He's actually executed by a British soldier. Who was he?
Dr. Warren, the book is about several key doctors of the American Revolution. They're friends. Dr. Warren is the president of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress. And Dr. Warren is a true hero of the Revolution. That day, the Congress promotes him to general, but Warren comes in with his musket and volunteers to be a private and battles on Bunker Hill and is killed there. The book is about his friendship also with Dr. Nathaniel Bond, who I mentioned earlier, who's a virus specialist. And another doctor, Dr. Benjamin Church.
Oh, we have two stories to tell now, Patrick. The little bird has come down in our studio. We must tell these stories. First of all of this is taking place in the middle of a pandemic, the smallpox pandemic, which has come to Massachusetts. How do they fight it, Patrick? What is their awareness of the pandemic?
It's the Patriots in the town of Marblehead. Well, ships from fishing ships from Marblehead bring back the virus to Marblehead in 1773-74, and it ravages the town. It devastates the town. Initially, they try to quarantine. They create something called pest houses. They fly a black flag. They even execute dogs, anything to try to quarantine or isolate it. That doesn't really work. Dr. Bond comes to the scene and promotes inoculation, and inoculation in the 18th century is dangerous. It's like Russian roulette. It's taking a knife and lancing a portion of your shoulder and putting a small portion of the virus in the body with the hope that you'll have a small light version of the virus that will create the antibodies that you need to defend it off a full blown version. For the most part, inoculation works. The Patriots come up with a plan to have an inoculation hospital, and they build it in a place called Cat Island. It's a remote island. And they build a hospital for £2,000, an enormous amount of money at the time. But the virus is politicized. The camps within the town, the town's divided by loyalists and patriots. And the loyalists encourage and support a mob of men in the dead of night that row over to Cat Island with torches and tar in hand, and they torch the entire hospital with people inside it. It's a miracle that nobody was killed. There are women and children in there. The Patriots know who these people were that did that, and they go to the sheriff. The sheriff arrests the individuals, but the loyalists in the town organize a massive mob of well over 1,000 people, and they storm the jail with axes and crowbars, and they free the men. And then what happens next is the homes of the Patriots that funded the hospital are surrounded by an angry mob. It's here we really sort of see the steel of John Glover. He knows that they're coming. He takes a 6-pound cannon from one of his ships and he wheels it into the foyer of his home and he waits. And as soon as the mob shows up on his front lawn, he orders the doors thrust open and he has a lighted torch in hand next to the touch hole of the cannon and orders them to disperse, which they do.
That's one story, the physicians. We have the physician, Joseph Warren, who's a leader of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, who dies on Bunker Hill. And it's important detail here that he was shot in the face by a British officer at close range, according to Patrick's reporting. That is not entirely a killed in action. That is an execution of a leader. An assassination is what we call it in the 21st century. Patrick's told the story of Dr. Bond, who will become the man who rescues the Continental Army with his same skill set some years on. But now the story of Benjamin Church. And Patrick, I confess, being one of those readers who is oddly attracted to the rascal. Who is Church?
Church is extraordinary and exceptional. A Renaissance man, if you will, a man that can write poetry and songs. He's a medical doctor, considered the best in his field. And to everybody present, he's an ardent patriot. But in reality, he's a man that's greedy, has a lot of debts to pay, and he's still loyal to the crown. And he sits on all of the major committees of the Massachusetts provincial government. He's a key leader that writes many things. He's influential. He's a decision maker, but he's also General Gage's greatest spy. And he is funneling he's in the Patriot Nerve Center, basically funneling all the most crucial intelligence directly to General Gage. General Gage knows exactly where all of the munitions are stored. He knows exactly what the Patriots are up to because Dr. Benjamin Church is informing General Gage of every movement of the Patriots.
Church is everywhere and never really found out profoundly. Suspect, but never really found out profoundly.
No.
He's a rascal. He's a gambler. He's a ladies' man. He's a drinker. But he's, as Patrick presents him, colorful. You can't help but watch him when he enters the scene. He steals it.
He has many... many mistresses, including one in Marblehead. And, he's a ladies' man. He's very charming. And he communicates to General Gage in cipher code. During the Battle of Lexington and Concord, he pretends to battle. He even sprinkles a little blood on his stockings and has, an incredible story for everything, basically. And people believe him.
The significance here is that, to me, Patrick, as a reader, is that Church makes it clear this is a civil war. Because from the point of view of the crown, Church is a patriot and an honest man who endorses the empire and is assisting at great risk to himself of being found out from the point of view of London. And that means that this isn't all about ideology. It's about who is an Englishman and who is an Englishman, back and forth. One more detail about Bunker Hill. They retreat from Bunker Hill. Do the Marbleheaders think it's a defeat?
Yeah, they initially do consider it a defeat because, Samuel Trevitt, they look for scapegoats. And Samuel Trevitt is the one of the men that they go after for the loss, even though he was one of the great one of the few Americans that had a cannon that battled, at least. The reality is it was a Pyrrhic victory for the British Empire because they sustained massive casualties with the frontal assaults on, going up Bunker Hill.
The icon is about to arrive on the battlefield. The book is The Indispensables. The diverse soldier mariners who shaped the country, formed the Navy, and rode Washington across the Delaware. Marblehead, Massachusetts is what we're talking about. And when we come back, Marblehead meets Washington. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with the author, Patrick O'Donnell. His new book, The Indispensables, The Diverse Soldier Mariners Who Shaped the Country, Formed the Navy, and Rode Washington Across the Delaware. Arriving in July of 1775, straight from the Congress, is George Washington to take command. What was the Marblehead opinion of Washington when he first arrived? Were they affectionate towards him as they became?
George Washington needed a headquarters, and that headquarters was at the Vassal House, and it was the Marbleheaders that were guarding the Vassal House. That's where they encamped. And Washington develops a very unique and important relationship with the Marbleheaders. He trusts them. And that bond of trust is something that will extend through the entire Revolution. And they guard Washington, and it's here at the Vassal House that, Washington is also introduced to nautical things. It's John Glover who's in charge of the regiment at this point. And powder becomes, it remains the crucial supply. They need it badly. Washington takes an inventory of the army, and the men that are camped around the Vassal House and around Boston are, thousands strong, but they have in their cartridge boxes 7 or 8 cartridges. There's hardly any powder at all. If the British charge out, they may not even be able to fend them off. And Washington is coming up with, he realizes that he is in dire straits. And they start to figure, they come up with ideas on how to get more powder. One of them is to potentially raid Halifax, which has in Canada, large stores of powder. But they need to get there, and they need a ship. And that's where Washington relies on John Glover.
This is we're about to meet Washington's Navy. Quite extraordinary, because Congress was not part of this decision making. Washington creates his own navy, and it was purposeful. It was for powder, but it's led by and participated in by the Marblehead sailors. So these are perfect Marines who lay down their military land fighting and take up the sea fighting. Chief among them is John Manley. Who is he?
John Manley is got sort of a mysterious past. He may have been born in England. He might have been born in Boston. But he's a Marbleheader, and John Manley is one of the captains that Glover and Washington find, and they have a series of, they're known as cruisers. These are very fast ships. They're lightly armed, in most cases about four-pound cannon, 4 pound being the weight of the ball. And their goal is to intercept British transports, which are laden with powder. And that's the main goal, powder ordnance, anything else they can get their hands on, because the Continental Army is in such desperate need of powder and other supplies. And they see all these transports coming in, and they think, well, there's a possibility that a fast ship could pick off one of these ships and seize the powder. And that's exactly what happens with John Manley. He captures one of the richest prizes of the entire war, a ship that's laden with ordnance and also a massive mortar that they renamed the Congress, which they use at the siege of, on Dorchester. They use on Dorchester Heights when they bombard the British in Boston. And, the ship comes at exactly the right time. They capture this ship, and they capture many other ships that provide the army with crucial powder at exactly the right time, at the right place.
Washington's Navy eventually will have, I have the names of the ships, 5 ships, the Lee, the Warren, the Hancock, the Franklin, and the Lynch. However, Washington's Navy is not all smooth going, because what we have here are men who have different attitudes about their risk and how they should present themselves to Washington, who is appointing leadership, but without really the writ of Congress. You can say, again, this is a civil war where there's spontaneity and regret and resentment. Patrick tells these stories repeatedly. They're quite turning, because there's not a sharp difference between being a patriot and being self-interested, back and forth. I mention this because these are pirates from the British point of view, and eventually will fight sea battles with the British. Some of them will be captured and escape and then come back. It's one of the revelations of Patrick's book, Washington's Navy. There's another revelation, however. We've got very little time here in Massachusetts before we're on to New York and New Jersey and the famous incident at the Delaware. The forming of the Life Guard, led by Caleb Gates. Who are they, Patrick?
The Life Guard, I mean, Washington, he needs somebody to guard his headquarters full time, because he realizes that if the British conduct a raid and they capture Washington, the indispensable man, if you will, of the Revolutionary War, it could end the revolution. So Washington comes up with a volunteer group of handpicked men known as the Commander-in-Chief's Guard, or the Life Guard more commonly. And it's led by a Marbleheader, Caleb Gibbs, who Washington meets at the Vassal House first, and he develops a strong trust with Gibbs. And he has to develop this entire group from scratch. It's a early precursor, if you will, to the Secret Service. They not only guard the Commander in Chief, but they guard his papers. They also have the authority to act or issue orders on behalf of the Commander in Chief. And as the war goes on, they even conduct special missions and are in battle as well. But Gibbs, who was basically a second in command, if you will, of the Marblehead Regiment, is now in charge of the Life Guard. And the Guard is just a fascinating story, John. I mean, it's they organized a group of volunteers, handpicked men from various units. Washington wants drilled men, so to speak, men that had been in combat. But unfortunately, that also means some former British soldiers that are now part of the Continental Army. And they are also part of the Guard, and there's some intrigue there as they go towards New York.
Before we leave Massachusetts, is Beverly a pirate den? What is Beverly to the Marbleheaders?
Beverly is right located right next to Marblehead, but it has a really unique port. It's a protected port that can be easily defended. But the port itself is also has lots of. It's very, very difficult to get into Beverly Port unless you know it. And this works in the Patriots' behalf because you need to have a skilled pilot to navigate the waters, because there's sandbars, everything else. The Royal Navy, if they tried to attack or enter Beverly without a skilled pilot, would probably beach their craft. And that's what they were relying upon when they built basically the Washington's Navy. It spawned at Glover's Wharf, which is in Beverly, where there's warehouses, et cetera. And many of the ships sail from Beverly, which is very heavily defended. And it's where they sail out of and they sail back into with their prizes and they whatever they seized.
A sea battle, February of 76. Patrick's book is filled with these wonderful moments. The Manly, now Commodore of the Washington's Navy, takes on the British warship Sea Nymph, I believe, and one other. And they battle with his, I guess he has a flotilla of ships that sail. Who wins that battle? Does the Royal Navy write up that battle in some heroic fashion?
It's quite interesting. If you're familiar with the term Q-ship, this is what the Sea Nymph was. It was, in a sense, it was a Revolutionary War Q-ship. It was the British attempt to...
We have 30 seconds.
Vessel,
Patrick, we have 30
seconds.
Go ahead.
To make it look like one of Washington's cruisers. And they literally tried to stalk Manly with this vessel, and they had some interesting, you know, battles at sea, you know, versus Manly against the Sea Nymph, et cetera.
Before there was the Continental Navy, we're going to New York. Patrick O'Donnell, The Indispensables, about the Marbleheaders. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with the author, Patrick O'Donnell. His new book, The Indispensables, The diverse soldier mariners who shaped the country formed the Navy and rode Washington across the Delaware. This is the story of Marblehead, Massachusetts, and its brave, self-sacrificing volunteers during the Revolution, which was also a civil war. Their neighbors were loyalists, and yet they survived the war, fought all the way through. We are now in 1776. The Marbleheaders have formed the Life Guard around Washington, in addition to having a Marblehead regiment with the Continental Army. Washington has moved his headquarters from the Siege of Boston, the British withdrew, to New York, to Manhattan himself. Washington is going to Manhattan. He's now headquarters on Pearl Street. He's guarded by the Life Guard, led by Caleb Gibbs of Marblehead and others. And there's an assassination plot. Patrick, a very good evening to you. Wonderful, the storytelling, especially the assassination of George Washington, and gets my attention. Who was behind this, and how was it put together? Good evening.
Good evening, John. This is the Loyalist Governor, Tryon, who is behind the plot along with other plots. And he tries through his intermediaries to recruit members of the Life Guard to assassinate George Washington. And there are a number of members of the Guard that have Loyalist leanings, including a guy by the name of Hickey, who's a former British soldier. And another member of the Guard is a guy by the name of Green, who's a drummer. And they meet up with a gunsmith who happens to be Tryon's intermediary named Forbes.
William Tryon is the Loyalist governor of New York. Please continue.
They meet at a grog shop, and they start to talk. And they talk politics. And before you know it, they're members of the Guard are actually raising their glass to the king. And, Forbes senses an opening, and he starts to, you know, work at the two men. And he's very clever about it initially. He sort of puts out a few feelers and then blows off Hickey and Hickey, but Hickey comes back. And then the plot starts to thicken, and they propose basically the plan is that these members of the Guard will try to recruit other members of the Guard, and they will assassinate Washington, and then also blow up different powder magazines, etc., that are under the hands of the commander in chief.
So the plot was not only to kill Washington, it was to destroy the black powder again. It's always the British plan. If you deprive them of gunpowder, they cannot continue their fight. How is it found out, Patrick?
Well, what happens is Hickey gets nailed for trying to palm off a counterfeit bill. You know, at this time, money is scarce. It's either, you know, hard money is hard to come by. So their colonies are printing their own money, and they try to palm off. Hickey tries to palm off fake money. And he gets arrested, and he and Green are both put in confinement. And what happens is, you know, they had no idea that they were plotting to kill Washington, but these two men start to talk to somebody else in the jail cell. And then that individual basically rats on Hickey and Green and informs them that these guys were trying to kill Washington. And Washington has, you know, he develops some, he encourages something called a committee of intestines. Part of it, it's John Jay is involved in this. And this is really the birth of American counterintelligence, where they try to find out what these men did and knew. And, they're very successful on uncovering, elements of the plot. And it's the Guard themselves, under Gibbs, that arrests anybody else that was involved in it.
Hickey's the only one executed. Why?
Well, I think that this would have been a devastating blow, obviously. If the British had been able to kill Washington, it could have potentially ended the revolution. I mean, this is a leadership headshot, basically. But the other thing is, it's a PR disaster to have your own members of the Guard, you know, plotting against you along with other, in many other people. So Washington, it seems, we really don't know the motivation, but it seems like he only narrowed in on, focused in on one person. And that was Hickey, because it makes sense. He was a former British soldier, so it's easier to pin treason on him. And he is executed publicly in front of throngs of thousands of people.
In June of 1776 on Manhattan, we go immediately to late August 1776 on Long Island. August 29th, Washington and his army of 9,000 are trapped. They've been defeated by the British in the Battle of Long Island. And it would have been worse except for the Immortals, the Maryland regiment that Patrick has written about at length prior to this. However, the uncritical part is not only that there was a way to stop the British offensive that would have overrun Washington and his lifeguard, but also how do they get off Long Island given that the harbor is filled with British ships. Patrick, you titled this chapter The American Dunkirk. It is profound. Washington is lucky again, not only with having the Marbleheaders, but also the weather. First of all, the Marbleheaders, how did they propose to get 9,000 men under the cover of watched by the British across the East River?
Yeah, John, this is really arguably one of the singular inflection points of the Revolution where, had the British been successful, they would have destroyed the Continental Army and probably ended the American Revolution. The army was, its backs were up against the East River. It was under siege by Lord Howe's army in Brooklyn Heights, and it was trapped there. And Washington had a decision to make. Does he continue to stand and fight, or does he retreat? And he wisely decided to retreat. And, you know, the atmospherics here, they're really, really spectacular. There is a nor'easter that hits the armies right after the Battle of Brooklyn, where, as you mentioned, it's Washington's Immortals make an epic stand. As one historian said, an hour more, buying us an hour more precious in our history than any other. This Thermopylae-like stand allows the army to escape into its entrenchments at Brooklyn Heights. And now Washington has a decision to make. And he decides to retreat, but the options are very, this is one of the most difficult military maneuvers to make, being under fire to make a river crossing, an evacuation in night. And the men, the Marblehead Regiment, are initially told that they are going to attack with the rest of the army. They then are the first to the boats, which are small boats, a variety of craft, all different sorts and sizes. And they have to do the impossible. They have to cross a mile-long East River that is swirling. It is, it's not, there's currents, everything. Nothing is cooperating. The wind is not even cooperating for the Americans. They're not able to use their sails to get across the river. Nothing is working. In fact, they try to abandon the evacuation that night. The commander that's in charge, the overall in charge of the operation, tries to find Washington to call it off. But he can't find Washington, so it proceeds. A loyalist even tries to tip off Lord Howe and the British Army that the Americans are retreating, but, you know, a variety of things happen there. That doesn't work, and the operation proceeds going forward, and it's the Marbleheaders and their skill that ferries the army across, because they are trained in the most deadly seas in the world, the Grand Banks. So this is something that their skill set is very unique, and it's only they can bring them across in this harrowing hour.
Patrick presents a brilliant scene of complete despair. The army is trapped. The fog settles on New York Harbor. The boats are inadequate, and they're filled to the point that, Patrick, the detail here is there's 3 inches above the water. That's how many men and equipment. They take the equipment off first, thinking that if the equipment is gone, the army has nothing to fight with, so it will leave. The army starts at 10 p.m. It's raining, and the tides don't oblige. But at some point, Patrick, here's the miracle. The wind shifts sometime in the middle of the night. There's no way they could have planned that. but the marbleheaders, and they use cloth-covered oars. Was that to keep them quiet, Patrick?
It was, John. And the other thing that's really miraculous is the wind didn't shift for the British Navy. Had they been able to shift for their sails to sail up the East River, they would have intercepted Glover's men as they were going across in these small boats and blown it to smithereens. But the wind did not cooperate for the British. It then changed and cooperated for us. And that's just one of the first kind of miracles, if you will, because as, you know, as dawn starts to set in, there's chaos on the docks or the evacuation area. And it's Washington himself that's one of the last to leave. I mean, this is leadership at its finest. And I mean, one of the scenes that I have is he has, you know, enormous strength and he raises this giant boulder above his shoulders and says, I will sink this boat to hell if there's not order. And the men then, you know, fall in line. And it's at this point another miracle occurs and a fog comes in and screens the dawn and in the sun from the in the movement of the army across the East River.
The book is The Indispensables. Patrick O'Donnell is the author. We're headed to the Delaware River. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Patrick O'Donnell, the author of the new book, The Indispensables, the story of the Marbleheaders, the fishermen who become the strength of Washington's ability to cross water in the turmoil of the Continental Army battle with the British regulars, first-rate British soldiers. It is now December 25th, 1776, at McConkie's Ferry on the Delaware River. Washington's 2,400 volunteers in winter quarters are ordered to cross the river to attack Trenton. But crossing the river means that you must deal with ice floes in the Delaware and another nor'easter. Patrick, there's a photo, there's a painting at the Museum of Art in New York of Washington's crossing. It is not necessarily accurate because it was painted, 70, 80 years later, but it does convey the challenge of the river. How did they do it, Patrick? Is there an explanation for how they crossed that river with those Durham boats?
They had Durhams and flat-bottom boats, John. And, yeah, it's the skill of the Marbleheaders that once again bring the army to safety. All other attempts to cross the river that night failed, John. None of them got across. It was only the Marbleheaders and their skill in the boats that were able to bring the army across. And this was a mission impossible. The river was not cooperating. The currents, everything was going wrong once again. But it's the skill of the Marbleheaders that they had developed in the Grand Banks. It is also working as a team. You know, many of these men were on fishing boats together. And, you know, it's really quite unique. It's a diverse group. You know, you have African-Americans, free African-Americans. There's some Hispanic members in the unit. All of these men work as a team. It's a unit. It's about unity. And in a crisis situation, they come together and are able to get the army across in the middle of the Northeast.
Not only the army, but 19 cannon, I believe. That's what Henry Knox commanded, 19 cannon, which is an extraordinary amount of iron and brass cannons for a unit only 2,400 strong. Washington's army was overgunned, and American armies have been overgunned ever since. I want to read some of these names, Patrick, because they're not commonplace, but these are the names of the Marbleheaders. Captain Thomas Grant, William Curtis, Nathaniel Bond, Thomas Fosdick, William Hawks, Edward Archibald, Tom Grant Jr., Joshua Orne, son of Azar Orne, John Savage, John Russell, and then the free men of color, Aesop Hale, Romeo, Caesar Glover, Oliver Cromwell, rowing across the Delaware after 10 p.m. in a nor'easter. But they're not done, Patrick. They don't all have shoes, but they're marching on Trenton. And I believe Glover's regiment was in the right flank. He was attacking down the road. Is that correct?
He was attacking down the river road, which parallels the Delaware River. And they were in the vanguard. And, you know, picture the army. Many of these men did not have shoes. There was literally blood stains in the snow as they trekked forward. That was the condition of the army at this time. It was this is extraordinary in terms of endurance and resilience and just individuals that were pushed to the limit from the weather and then also the British Army. And they trekked down the road. They marched down the road. And it's Glover and the Marbleheaders that capture the most crucial real estate in North America. They capture the crucial Assunpink Creek Bridge. And this is important because in the 18th century, most armies would battle. And then when one army had the advantage over the other army would retreat. And the battle would be, just a regular engagement. This was a decisive double envelopment because Glover captured the bridge, and it was the only means of escape, really, for Johann Rahl. And they also put position cannon on the high ground above Assunpink Creek Bridge, and they were able to pelt Johann Rahl's army with the cannon.
Cannon commanded by Alexander Hamilton, a future Secretary of the Treasury and author of several documents that become important. And James Monroe, yes, he was Monroe, was with the cannon.
Well, Monroe was part of, and Hamilton were part of a little bit of an earlier engagement, and that's really an interesting story, too. James Monroe is a bona fide war hero. He attacks several Hessian cannons earlier, a little bit earlier in the battle, and is very critically wounded. And it's really quite serendipitous. As the army was marching down the river road, they were ordered to detain anybody that was a civilian that had come out. And one of the people that came out that night, because his dog was barking, is a Dr. Riker. Dr. Riker was a patriot, and he volunteered. Marches with Monroe, and it's Monroe that is nearly mortally wounded as he's trying to seize this cannon, Hessian cannon. It's Dr. Riker that saves his life, and then we now have a fifth president because of that.
The Battle of Trenton is resolved with the capture of most of the Hessians. However, that is not the end of the story. What is happening now is they have made a success, but the British are aware that Washington has charged across the river. And we're going to move forward. But before that, the Marbleheaders are exhausted, John Glover in particular. They make a decision whether they should stay in Washington's army or leave. Half of them leave to march back to Marblehead. Why I emphasize that, Patrick, is that, again, this is a civil war more than a revolution at this point. And Washington has to acknowledge that their exhaustion is genuine. They've made it possible for him to cross the river. They've made it possible for him to take Trenton. But they have families, and John Glover in particular has an ill wife, and so he leaves Washington's army. However, some of the Marbleheaders stay on, and that's important for what follows Trenton. The great success of Trenton is going to be followed by perhaps the two most important battles at this point to sustain the revolution, Assunpink Creek and Princeton. This is The Indispensables by Patrick O'Donnell. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Bash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Patrick O'Donnell. The book is The Indispensables. The diverse soldier mariners who shaped the country, formed the Navy, and rode Washington across the Delaware. Patrick, the Marbleheaders divide. John Glover leads one contingent home to Marblehead. His wife is ill. They're exhausted. They're sick. Their clothes are filled with vermin. Rubbed raw, you give some brilliantly detailed analysis of how exhausted they are. But some of the Marbleheaders stay on. And they stay on to fight. And I'm looking at 1227, several days later, at Assunpink Creek. Please describe what the scene is and why Assunpink becomes so critical.
This is also known as the Second Battle of Trenton, and a variety of factors basically lead Washington back across the Delaware. It wasn't really necessarily initially part of his plan. but John Cadwalader and the Philadelphia Associators, it's a militia group, if you will, they were one of the groups that tried to cross on Christmas, and it failed. They couldn't get across because they didn't have the skilled hands of the Marylanders in their boats, or Marbleheaders in their boats. But they went across anyways a few days later, and they make it across. And also, the militias in New Jersey are uprising, and Washington has a dilemma on his hands. Does he support Cadwalader or order him back across? And he decides to go back, and he crosses the Delaware River. And again, but he doesn't make the mistake that Johann Rall had of trying to defend Trenton itself, which was pretty much indefensible. He sets up on the high ground at Assunpink Creek, and he tries to defend the bridge, which is the choke point. And he also has his army arrayed across Assunpink. It goes about a mile long, their line. And it's General Cornwallis who organizes the British force to retaliate after what happens at Trenton, and to strike the blow at Washington.
So
this is a great army. They have this is, you know, the best units in the British Army.
I want to list it because you have a very careful detail. This is light infantry, 8,000, including grenadiers. These are not second raters. These are the best of the British Army, and they're going to destroy Washington. Washington knows this. He knows that they're coming for him. What are his decisions, friends? Patrick?
His decision is to try to defend, and he has initially a collapsible defense where he has Edward Hand, who's this skilled, he has a series of riflemen that are set up in front of Trenton.
These are the Pennsylvanians, the Edward Hand's Pennsylvanians.
And they pick off a number of the British Army, and they delay them. And this is important because they chew up daylight. And it delays the British Army long enough that it's in the afternoon that they finally make their way to Assunpink Creek Bridge, and they mount. They know that if they capture the bridge.
This is December 30th, 1776. Please continue, Francis.
If they capture the bridge, they'll probably destroy the American Army, because then they'll cut it in half and be able to basically really wreak havoc. And it's here that the Marbleheaders and Marylanders and many, many members of the Continental Army make an epic stand on the bridge. And it's Washington himself that is nearby. There's one account that says his horse literally touches one of the rails of the bridge. He's that close in directing things. And they hold against the best, the cream of the British Army, the Grenadiers, are making, you know, assault after assault on this bridge, but it's the Americans that hold. And they hold long enough for night to come in, and this is where, had the British attacked again, they might have destroyed the army. But Washington decides on a feint. He decides to pretend to dig in and to pretend that he's going to launch an attack. He is a group of men with campfires and shovels and pickaxes, kind of giving the intent that they're going to resume the battle the next morning, when in reality they decide to strike out to the north and attack Princeton, where there's the garrison. And eventually they want to make their way all the way to where the British have another garrison, as well as a massive war chest of powder and supplies, as well as money. And it was an enormous fortune had they been able to make it that far. But
all right, let's go to the Battle of Princeton. This is the 3rd of January, several days later. And again, the Cornwallis has sent first-rate troops. And this particular instance, there were 700 in a brigade under a man named Mawhood, Redcoats. And there was a meeting engagement, because the part of the Continental Army was coming through the woods, as I'm following Patrick's reporting here. Are the Marbleheaders present in that battle with Mawhood?
Yes, some of them are, including Dr. Bond, as well as some of the other key members of the Marblehead Regiment. Many of them, including John Glover, had gone home to Marblehead, which at this time was an economic mess.
Right.
People were starving. Glover's family, his wife was on her deathbed, and they literally had a food riot. I chronicle a story of how the women of Marblehead, bore muskets and raided the food stores. It was that bad. But a large portion of the Marblehead Regiment stayed, including Dr. Bond. And many of these volunteers that stayed on would die subsequently.
I want to tell the Marblehead story because here is again and again how you puzzle about Washington's good fortune. The battle with Marblehead's 700 regulars, bayonets fixed to charge into the rebel line. Washington encourages again and again the troops to turn around and attack the British to keep up the fire. You report that he came on his horse within 30 paces of the British riflemen, and he's not shot. It's a striking fact about him that he was fearless, and I'm supposing that was part of the legend of George Washington. Was the lifeguard around him when he came that close to the British firing line?
They were around him, but Washington would typically ride with only a small group, and he wasn't riding with the whole guard, for instance. But he was. This is sort of miraculous. This is typical of an 18th century though battlefield commander. This is where they would literally enter the fray, and they could change the course of a battle. And the Battle of Princeton was not going well initially for the Americans. The British stood and fought, and elements of our unit, which of the army, which included militia and other members, initially started to fall back. And it would be Washington himself that would ride into the fray and encourage the men and change the course of the battle.
We also mentioned Alexander Hamilton, who had one of the cannons that he turned on Nassau Hall. But we're following the story of the Marbleheaders. And I want to follow through with that detail you mentioned about why John Glover men backed Marblehead. It was often the case that they would sign up for a certain period of time, but they had to care for their families as well, especially during the harvest or getting the planting out. So it was, I've read this story many times, where units would show up and then depart and show up and then depart. Washington had to manage that. And the Marbleheaders were in no way chastised, I believe, at the time. Is that correct, Patrick?
Well, they were in their right to leave because their enlistment had expired. And it was only, the men that stayed, and the men that stayed from other units too, are really true heroes. They stepped forward and volunteered, and it's really an extraordinary story because it was Washington himself that had to muster all of his great oratory skills to somehow convince these men who weren't getting paid for the most part to stay on. And those that stay on do extraordinary things, and many of them sadly perish, including Dr. Bond stays on, John. And what most people don't realize is the virus at this point was devastating the army. After Princeton, upwards of nearly 20% of the army was dying or infected by smallpox. And Washington was at a critical point. He knew that the virus could destroy his ability to continue to fight the British. And he orders Dr. Bond to set up inoculation hospitals like he had done at Cat Island in Marblehead. And Dr. Bond does that. They set up the hospitals, and Dr. Bond even conducts many of the inoculations himself, and they inoculate the army. Many consider this to be Washington's greatest strategic decision because the army is now inoculated, and it's able to fight on. And it's Dr. Bond who was initially canceled by an angry mob for treating those British soldiers back at Lexington and Concord that ultimately makes the ultimate sacrifice, and he dies as a result of his service to the Continental Army, vaccinating or inoculating it.
Patrick, I mentioned that it perhaps reading this story during our pandemic, I was again brought up to the fact that the revolution, the Civil War, all of this happened with the pall of the pandemic hanging over everyone. People were sick, people were dying. People couldn't take care of themselves while Washington is marching back and forth across the East Coast of the United States. And the British were also marching back and forth And your medical, Dr. Bond is, without Dr. Bond, I don't know if they get all the way to 1782. I just don't think that they could have lasted given the scale of the smallpox. Did the Marbleheaders also get inoculated when they marched back to Marblehead? Were they inoculated already?
Many of them were inoculated via the incidents that were going on prior to the beginning of the Revolution.
Patrick O'Donnell, the author of The Indispensables, the diverse soldier mariners who shaped the country, formed the Navy, and rode Washington across the Delaware. When we come back, whatever happened to? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Patrick O'Donnell, his new book is The Indispensables, the story of the Marbleheaders, Marblehead, Massachusetts. The diverse soldier mariners who shaped the country, formed the Navy, and rode Washington across the Delaware. Patrick is an historian of the 21st century. And one of the wonderful discoveries in this book is how much the story of the Marbleheaders are still with us through plaques, through houses, through memories, through statues. Patrick, take us to Marblehead today. Is there recognition of the sacrifice of the town? I believe you report at the end there were something more than 350 widows when the war ended. I mentioned John Glover, for example, who marched back to Marblehead in late 76. He is again brought back by Washington, who entreated him to come back to fight for Washington. He made him a general. And Glover goes on to fight with Gates at Saratoga. Glover stays in the war all the way to 1782. The Marbleheaders were the backbone of many of these successes. But today, what is remembered? Let's start with John Glover. What is in Marblehead for people to find, Patrick?
John Glover's house. John, there's not really much in plain sight. You have to sort of dig through it a little bit. But for instance, there is a plaque on John Glover's home, which still exists. Jeremiah Lee's house, who is a mansion. It still exists, and it's part of the Marblehead Museum, which I highly recommend everybody visit. It's extraordinary. And there's even the Three Cods Tavern still exists, where Samuel Trevitt, the hero of Bunker Hill, fought off British soldiers with a broomstick in a sword fight. There's stuff there. There's something called Old Burial Hill, where many of these men are buried. But their story was largely an untold one. You have to like look around to find it. But the remains of the regiment are there through their homes and their headstones.
You visited the graveyard. Who's buried there that you can tell us about?
John Glover and many of the other men, like the captain, another great captain, Captain Mugford, who I wrote about recently in an article. He captures a very important prize ship as well, filled with powder, literally nearly 50,000 pounds worth of, pounds sterling worth of powder that could supply the army for months. Many of the notables are buried in that cemetery. The cemeteries around the town are filled with these men. And, as you mentioned, tragically, nearly 400 widows as a result of the Revolutionary War, that was a tragedy of it. That many of them would be lost at sea, and their bodies would never be recovered because of the naval fighting, etc.
The Glover family suffered extremely. Glover lost his wife, yes, Hannah, but he also lost his son, and he lost his son-in-law. And did he lose his fortune?
John, for the most part, many of these men went bankrupt. I mean, as the, Marblehead was extremely prosperous prior to the American Revolutionary War. And then the war devastates the town. It not only many of their sons and husbands and fathers are killed, but, it's just the industry, the fishing is also in a decline. I mean, it really is hit very hard and devastated after the war.
And statues. Are there statues of these heroes?
Very, very few. There's a statue of one of the characters in the book is a private. His name is John Russell. And if you go to Trenton, there is a statue with of the Trenton. It's a victory memorial. And John Russell is one of the statues of one of the people there. And he's got an oar in his hand, to symbolize the crossing. There's also a statue of Glover in Boston, but for the most part, very little has been written about the Marbleheaders and their story, until the Indispensables.
Elbridge Gerry goes on to become Massachusetts governor. And that is the man for whom we name gerrymandering, but it is disdainful to mention gerrymandering here in the 21st century. I learned from Patrick that at the time it was not. It was understood as practical-minded. What about the success of the town today? Is it still a fishing town, Patrick, or has it become a suburb of Boston?
It's just a beautiful town that it's one of the most beautiful towns on the East Coast, because so many of these historic buildings remain, and it's just a wonderful place to visit. And they still have, for instance, they have a Memorial Day parade. They really, revel in, I wouldn't say revel, but they really bring on out American spirit there. It's a tremendous place to live.
And Washington, and you have at the close of your book a tribute by Henry Knox. First of all, let's establish again who Henry Knox was and what were his memories of the Marbleheaders. He went on to become a member of Washington's cabinet.
Henry Knox is one of my favorite characters. He's a rotund kind of guy that's got a deep voice, but he initially starts out in a street gang and able to somehow cobble enough money together to create a bookstore. And his bookstore is it's his way of learning things. And he becomes an expert on artillery. And Knox is the guy that brings back the guns from Fort Ticonderoga. And they eventually install them on Dorchester Heights. But Knox is also, one of Washington's top battle captains, if you will. And Knox is there for the crossing, and he paints a really incredible picture of how all was nearly lost.
It's a wonderful quote, if I can read from your book, Patrick, because you end the book with this. Knox addressing the Massachusetts legislature. "I wish the members of this body knew the people of Marblehead as well as I do. I could wish that they had stood on the banks of the Delaware River in 1776 in that bitter night when the commander-in-chief had drawn up his little army to cross it and had seen the powerful current bearing onward the floating masses of ice which threatened destruction to whomever should venture upon its bosom. I wish that when this occurrence threatened to defeat the enterprise, they could have heard that distinguished warrior demand, 'Who will lead us on?' and seen the men of Marblehead and Marblehead alone stand forward to lead the army along the perilous path to unfading glories and honors in the achievements of Trenton." Patrick, it's a pleasure to have learned all of this. Do you have an explanation why it took me into my eighth decade to learn about the men of Marblehead? Does it make sense to you, Patrick?
No, it's like so many stories, John, though. There's so much history in plain sight in many cases. But we have an incredible history that I think that's what the Indispensables is about. It's about, sort of reclaiming or rediscovering some of this incredible history that in our origin story, John, which is our most precious story.
Right.
That is revealed in the Indispensables.
The Indispensables, the diverse soldier mariners, Marblehead, who shaped the country, formed the Navy, and rode Washington across the Delaware. Also rode Washington, saved everything across the East River. Patrick O'Donnell is the author. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.